This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We also, me and my co-founder, we are from Vietnam, and which is one of the largest coffee producers in the world, while Finland consumes the most coffee in the world per capita. So that's like a great marketing message, and we just combined them and created Rain's Coffee Shoe.
According to a study conducted by Qantas International, footwear production is responsible for about 700 million metric tons of carbon dioxide, or 1.4% of total global climate emissions. The negative impact of athletic footwear in particular includes problematic waste stream and labor practices as well. So what can you do when you want to be responsible, but you need new kicks? This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with the founder of Rennes Original, Jesse Tran, about his company's unique method of manufacturing shoes from spent coffee grounds and recycled plastic. Then we revisit our discussion with independent journalist Brett Simpson as we imagine a world without traffic cops. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jesse Tran. Jesse is the CEO of Rennes Original, and he joins us from Helsinki, Finland. Jesse, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, Alex. Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me today.
So what makes Rennes Original shoes unique from a Nike or Adidas sneaker they might buy in a sporting goods store, Jesse?
Yes, so like I think that it should start like with the brand. So like you know, we started Rennes as like a sustainable brand for the young consumers. So all of our products actually made from sustainable materials, and so currently we have two product lines, and so both are shoes, and they are like you know, sneakers made from coffee waste and recycled plastic. So I think that it is a really cool combination, you know, of like coffee waste and functionalities with the styles for the young people. That is how we try to build our brands to be.
And explain the origin of this idea. Was Rennes the first to come up with this idea of taking coffee waste and applying it to the shoe industry? Or are there other companies that have done something like this?
So as far as we know, so we are the first one that do something similar to like do something like this, you know. I think that there are a few companies do something quite similar to us afterwards, but of course, you know, we are the first one. But of course, before us, I think that there are a few companies that, you know, use like coffee scent and you know, are like different parts of coffee waste. So for just to be clear, our coffee waste is the used coffee grounds. After you boil the coffee and then you throw the coffee grounds away, we took it and mix it with recycled plastic polyester and create something called coffee polyester yarn. So we are the first company that used this coffee polyester yarn to create like sneakers.
And which part of the sneaker uses this coffee polyester yarn, Jesse?
That would be the upper part of the sneakers. So the upper part, like 100%, that they use it from this coffee polyester yarn. And between the upper and then what we call in our industry the lining, which is the inside of the shoe, there's another layer, and that layer is purely made from recycled plastic, and that is like a nano waterproof layer.
And why don't you talk about your involvement in this? You're originally from Vietnam, but you came to Finland 10 years ago. Why don't you explain your background and how you got involved in Rennes?
Right. Yeah, so I was born and raised in Ho Chi Minh City, the largest city in Vietnam. It used to be called Saigon. And I came here as like a foreign student. Actually, both me and my co-founders, we are originally from Vietnam, so well, we were not born in Finland, but we have lived here for a long time, and both of us, we are like sneakerheads, and we have very strong experience in manufacturing, as well as e-commerce, you know, marketing, and we want to use our experience to create something that, you know, fulfill our passion, and we are, you know, like I said, we are sneakerheads, but we look around, at that time, it was like 2000 and the end of 2017, the beginning of 2018, we look around in the market and we couldn't find like any, you know, sustainable fashion brands that are actually, you know, for young people or like, you know, to our taste, which is like bold and really hip. Most of the sustainable products, they are quite innovative, actually, you know, from other brands. But the selling points are like the way that the products look, like the marketing message, or like the message that comes across is a little, in our opinion, is a little preachy. And you know, quite not very bold in our taste. So that's why we created Rents. But we launched our product. We it took a while for us to develop our first product, which is the Rents original one. It took us until like the end of 2019 for us to launch the our first product, the shoe.
And you said you have two models. Why don't you walk us through those if you can?
Yeah, so the first model is like a laceless shoe, and it is made from coffee waste and recycled plastic, and it also has like a waterproof layer. So this is like a urban walking shoe, and you know, so but of course, like, you know, once we launched it in the end of 2019, it became like one of the most successful fashion crowdfunding campaign in Europe. We saw over 500,000 euros. I think it's like, you know, almost $600,000 in 1.5 months, and then we sold the most actually to the US, and then, you know, followed by Germany, the UK, and Canada, and this is just the first generation. We imagine it's just like we designed it that way. It was like purely like a everyday use, urban walking shoes. But then we realized that a lot of because of the you know, anti-odor and waterproof functions of the shoes, so a lot of our customers actually use it for like other activities, like trekking. Some even use it for dancing, you know, running, and you know, mostly trekking, and some even use it to play sport, you know, weightlifting at the gym, badminton. So we decided that we would launch the second generation, also made from coffee waste and recycled plastic, but it has also like a lace and our proprietary sole system that makes the shoe really light and really bouncy for like high intensity activities. So the first gen is a coffee shoe that is, you know, for urban everyday use without lace. There's no lace, and the second one with lace, and you know, from higher intensity activity.
So if you can explain a little bit more in detail of how you get the coffee grounds and then what problem you're solving with the reuse of these grounds, Jesse.
Yeah, to be honest, right, like in the beginning, we didn't come up with the coffee shoes right away. You know, when we started this project in the beginning of 2018, was like we spent like a lot of time on the first material that we started to use it with was organic cotton, but that was not that sustainable, and it is also, right, you know, not super functional. And so, you know, after quite a while, then we realized that there's nothing special about the first prototype that we made. So then we found the coffee waste, and then we get back to the drawing board and come and create the coffee shoes. And the reason we chose coffee waste material, this one particularly, is because of the functionalities that it has, right? So it has like anti-odor, antibacteria, on top of, you know, made from waste and really sustainable. And also from a marketing point of view, it's great for us because we are a Finnish brand. So we are based in Finland, and now we have a team of 20 people. All of us are living in Finland, and we have our headquarters here. But we also, you know, me and my co-founder, we are from Vietnam, and which is one of the largest coffee producers in the world, while Finland consumes the most coffee in the world per capita. And so that is like a great marketing message. And we just combined them and created Rain's Coffee Shoe.
And the coffee waste itself, was there a problem with the way coffee was being disposed of previously that you're trying to address with repurposing it? Or is it just a product that was getting thrown away and it's better to reuse than to reinvent the wheel, so to speak?
Yeah, so at first, when we first encounter this this material, right, like we also had the same thinking, why you need to recycle these like bio waste materials. But then you know, when we research more, and then we realize that coffee waste actually emit methane, a lot of methane, you know, when it decomposes in the landfills. And and methane is like, you know, 32 times more potent than CO2 greenhouse gas. So it actually directly affects the climate change and greenhouse effect on our, you know, on the environment. So this is actually quite a big issue, because, you know, people usually associate like plastic with like all those bad, but, you know, bio waste still contribute to climate change. And so we think that, you know, the material made from like waste that is like decomposing in the landfill, so it's really cool for us originally, and then it has amazing functions, so that's why we created like the whole brand out of it.
So I gather you get the coffee grounds themselves from convenience stores in China, but where are the shoes themselves manufactured, Jesse?
Yeah, so currently 100% of our products I am manufacturing. We manufacturing them in Vietnam, where I'm from. But just to be clear, we are not only like a coffee waste fashion company. We are also having like other materials that we have been working on, and we will soon release more product, like more fashion categories, not only shoes, and made from other waste-based materials, not only from our coffee waste.
And where can Americans listening to this buy Rens? Where do you direct people? Just to your website?
Yeah, so currently we have like our own warehouse in Illinois. So we have like a warehouse in the US as well, because this is our biggest market. And yeah, people can just go on like rensoriginal.com to buy. But I think we also like will be soon available in some of the big department stores in the US, you know, starting first with like bigger cities. But for right now, we have our own warehouse in the US and our own Shopify store that you can just go on and buy the shoes.
Well, it's called Rens Original. People can go to rensoriginal.com to check it out. Jesse Tron. Jesse, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
All right. Thanks a lot, Alex. Thanks, everyone, for having me.
Everybody's got a pair of funky sneakers. Remember yours? I bet they're still lying around in your closet somewhere.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by journalist Brett Simpson. Brett, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Alex.
You have a new piece in The Atlantic entitled Why Cars Don't Deserve the Right of Way, the simplest way to make roads safer and reduce police violence at the same time. It's very interesting, and a concept that I've kind of wondered about as we have more and more high-profile police violence episodes unfold on our TV screens inevitably every year. Almost every month there's some new video of police abuse, and so much of it seems to be surrounding the traffic cop. Why don't you explain why it doesn't necessarily have to be this way in terms of our police force being our traffic cops?
Yeah, so this story centers around the city of Berkeley, which in July of 2020, you know, when there was this, you know, after following the killing of George Floyd, there was across the nation this movement toward rethinking and reimagining the police force and their prevalence in our lives. And the city of Berkeley was unusual in that in its police reform, it really targeted the traffic cop. And in doing so, it actually really targeted police violence at its root. I mean, as we've seen for so many Black and brown drivers, stops for minor infractions like a broken taillight or speeding too often turn deadly. You know, we have Philando Castile, Sandra Bland, and most recently, Dante Wright. Those were all during police traffic stops, you know, and so many more. So I followed this initiative over the course of the year, and at the same time really looked into the history of traffic enforcement and how police power has really grown in concert with the prevalence of the automobile and the violence of the automobile on our streets.
Yes, take us back 100 years, if you will, before the prevalence of the automobile and what role the beat cop might have had in a community versus that beat cop today driving around in, on their motorcycle in their car and how they engage with the citizenry in a vastly different way.
Right. Yeah, this is a really interesting kind of historical point that many of us, I think, forget. And that is that, or maybe don't know, that is that before the car, ordinary citizens rarely came in contact with law enforcement. And in fact, law enforcement budgets were much smaller and police bureaus were, you know, maybe a little more disorganized. They had reputations for being corrupt. This is something really well illustrated by historian Sarah Sayo, who wrote a book in 2019 called Policing the Open Road. And she traced the origins and the development of police power as something that was really a response to this automobile that was tearing through the streets in the 1910s and 1920s. So just taking us back to, you know, maybe the year 1900, you had citizens that had a really well-negotiated relationship with each other on the street, where the street was a place of commerce, of activity, for, you know, social interactions. You would see horses, you would see children, you would see carts. It was all a socially negotiated space and one that, you know, police may or may not play a role in. But once they had these automobiles that were just bringing all of this speed and horsepower, they were wreaking havoc on the streets, and police forces really stepped in to solve that problem and become that official that could help negotiate those power relationships. And that is something that actually started in Berkeley. The father of modern American policing, as he's known now, August Vollmer, was Berkeley's first police chief. And he was the first to put cops in cars, and that was part of his vision for this new kind of cop who was tasked with solving crimes. So that origin story and the kind of the century of repercussions that August Vollmer, you know, may or may not have really seen coming was of interest to me as well. That here we have Berkeley, which reimagined policing 100 years ago with all of these consequences in response to the automobile, is now taking another shot at it and really looking to extricate the traffic cop.
Let's turn from August Vollmer's solutions and look at a concerned citizen, if you will, Darrell Owens, who you spotlight mm-hmm. in the piece and the solutions that he's proposing to his city in Berkeley.
Yeah, so Darrell Owens, he's really the member of a large coalition that crosses you know, many different disciplines, from climate and street safety activists to racial justice advocates, who are all kind of looking at the same problem, which is that there's something in our streets that's broken. We see police everywhere monitoring corners, giving tickets to people on their bikes, and yet our streets aren't getting any safer. We still have pedestrian injuries and just, you know, car accidents all the time. And so Daryl is something of a transportation nerd, and he was, you know, looking at the data and just seeing how, and he really, you know, he only rides public transportation. He rides his bike, and he's seeing how cars are the root of both injury and violence for the ordinary people, but also as a young Black man, he sees in his family and in his community that cars are the source of interactions with the police.
Why don't you walk us through the proposals that he made to the city council?
Yeah, so Daryl Owens, as part of this BRCDOT coalition, proposed shifting traffic enforcement away from the police to unarmed Department of Transportation workers. So this is kind of saying the same people who maybe enforce the rules of the road are the ones who design them and the ones who can kind of get at the root cause of the problems with the street. And so it's a really kind of the way that Owens would characterize it, just a simple common sense solution. Like, why do we need an armed officer trained with a warrior mindset to tell us that we need to update our license plate tags? It's just, it doesn't make any sense. It's a confusing allocation of resources, and it's a source of violence that disproportionately affects Black and brown people. And so, yeah, the proposal is kind of as part of a larger reimagining that eventually would furnish this Department of Transportation with workers who could target and redesign the highest injury corridors in the city and, you know, and do all of the really important transportation fixes that would hopefully reduce, at the same time, the power of the automobile and the power of police in the city.
Well, you'll know me when you see me, cause my door's painted white with my siren screaming and my flashing red light. I work all day and I have all night just to keep in law and order, trying to do what's right. If I write you out a ticket, then you'd better drive slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol. I'm the highway patrol, the highway patrol. My hours are long and my pay is low, but I'll do my best to keep you driving slow. I'm just doing my job, I'm the highway patrol.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking with independent reporter Brett Simpson. So, Brett, I guess the people who would be against this change would say, well, technology has evolved where we can have speed cams and we can update registration tags, etc. But that encroachment is also something that people fear. Where do we find a balance?
Right, yeah. This is something that I don't even get to in my piece, but Mothers Against Drunk Driving did come out against the bill immediately. And I think that it is interesting to just acknowledge that cars are dangerous and drivers can be dangerous. And, you know, we do need to address this danger. It's really, you know, do we need an armed cop addressing this danger?
What could a potential enforcement of drunk driving laws look like by removing officers? Is it possible?
Yeah, I think that's a really thorny question, and it's for the vast majority of cases, whether it's speeding enforcement doesn't change driver behavior. I think that the model would be that if there is someone driving recklessly, in so many of these police reform measures, a civilian enforcer would be able to escalate to a police officer, and maybe then a police officer does get involved. In the most dangerous situations, or, you know, like a carjacking or a high-speed chase. Like, all of those are things that can still be in the wheelhouse of the police force. And in fact, they're essential and they're well-trained. And they're trained for situations like that. They're not necessary for situations where someone, you know, forgets to signal before they turn.
So Brett, let's look at it from the police standpoint. How do police unions and units, how have they addressed these new type of proposals to remove officers from face-to-face vehicular-oriented interactions?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting point because one key counterargument is, you know, you take examples like Sweden and in Norway and that have these amazing numbers with, not needing a traffic cop to enforce their safety. Not needing an armed traffic cop, yet these countries also don't have such an armed citizenry. And so this argument like, well, if any ordinary American might have a gun in their car, then you don't know what to expect when you approach the window.
So I guess the question is, should they be approaching the window in the first place?
Yeah, at the same time, and I did speak with many Berkeley officers, Berkeley and otherwise, for this story. It didn't make it into the piece, but nobody likes being a traffic enforcer. You know, it's kind of maybe not nobody, but it does kind of seem to be the worst part of the job. And when you any cop can do that, or sometimes that will be their beat, their rotation for a little while. And overwhelmingly, they talk about it with a sense of dread. And also it's sort of a distraction from their really essential duties that they're performing in society, which is investigating and solving crimes, and really where they should be putting their energy. It's not about, you know, reducing headcount in police forces. It's about how and where are these officers spending their time, and is there a better way to allocate that? Maybe if we start the conversation there with these current police forces, then that is a more palatable conversation to the forces themselves. But yeah, it's certainly, I think, a thorny issue.
And one with race right at the center, if you think about the policy makers versus the vulnerable populations.
Right. And I think that, you know, the goal to reduce ordinary citizens' interaction with the police, which overwhelmingly, disproportionately affects communities of color, I think is a really great starting point for so many of these police reform proposals.
Well, the piece is called Why Cars Don't Deserve the Right of Way. It's in the Atlantic. We'll link to it at seachangeradio.com. Brett Simpson, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Chuck Mangione, Willie Bobo, and Red Simpson.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.